your gamer's role. www.b20radio.com.
Game on. Hey, hey, Gamer Nation. Sit down and get comfy, because this is episode 13 of Game On. I'm your host, Brian, and with me until the end of time is your plastic pal who's fun to be with, Andy.
That's right. 50,000 times more intelligent than a human, or 30 billion times more intelligent than a live mattress. Now, if only I could solve my own problems instead of everyone else's. How you doing, Gamer Nation? Brian, how the heck are you?
Why, I'm absolutely amazing. So I'm told. How you doing, Andy?
Swell.
Swell?
Swell, yes. The swelling has gone down.
Has it? You know. Okay, that's good. I'm glad.
It's getting better.
If you lay off the burritos.
Yeah, going for that big box expansion.
Woo! Hey, what are we going to be talking about today, Andy?
Well, today's topic is a fairly serious one, Gamer Nation. Today, Brian and I are going to be talking about using games as skill trainers. Brian has a rather unique job, and he sometimes uses games to help him do it. Stay tuned and find out what it's all about.
What is it all about?
You know, I'm still working on that one.
Okay. Upkeep phase. The D20 Radio Network has put out some fine shows this past week.
Indeed. Episode 57 of the Order 66 podcast is up, but only just. Seems GM Chris had some trouble getting to the show on time, and Dave went on ahead without him. There's a guest host involved who courageously attempted to tread water on short notice, but thankfully, Chris was eventually allowed onto the show.
Thank you, Jesus. Still oh my
God. They still managed to cover some useful stuff, including the Outlaw Prestige class for Star Wars Saga Edition from the Scum and Villainy book. So tune in to episode 57. GM Chris is outlawed. And check out the fun.
Fun. That would be one word for it.
That was a heavily loaded toboggan, I'll tell
you
what.
Man, oh man. Meanwhile, this Super Gaming Podcast, Episode 8, sees Mostly Joe interviewing Jerry Grayson of Kepra Publishing. Joe and Jerry talk about D6 Powers Revised, Godsend Agenda, and the new Hellas Worlds of Sun and Stone. Download it today.
Worlds of Sun and Stone. I'm guessing the Sun world is not very hospitable.
Yeah, not, well, you know, take the right SPF.
SPF 4 billion.
Yeah.
The Holocron went live today with episode number 7, Bounty Hunters and Spring Cleaning. Join GM Dave and Mostly Joe as they discuss the latest from the upcoming Star Wars The Old Republic MMO. Bounty Hunters appear to be a confirmed class, and Joe and Dave tell you what they think. Also, find out the beginning details of the Order of 66, D20 Radio's very own guild. It should prove interesting, so give it a listen.
You can find out more about these podcasts and others, and check out our community forums at www.d20radio.com. There's a ton of neat stuff to be found, so give it a look.
Start wearing goggles around you.
Little windshield wipers.
Yeah.
Bits and Pieces.
Well, Gamer Nation, time for some news and information in a segment we call Bits and Pieces.
Just in case you couldn't tell. The latest collectible miniatures news is that a sale of certain former WizKids properties by Topps is imminent. That there will be new HeroClix sets is fairly certain, but perhaps we will see the return of Mage Knight in 2009 as well. While an official announcement is a few days away, Jake Theus at Save HeroClix has declared that a deal exists in principle between Topps and a newly formed game company. Theus's Pinata Games will be involved on some level. The prior reported involvement of Catalyst Games was not mentioned. The original post at www.saveheroclix.com makes the following points. Point number the first. We, Pinata, have reached a deal in principle with the new game company formed to purchase HeroClix. We're on board, and once their deal with Topps closes, we'll be back working full-time on HeroClix. The new company will staff up to support the transitioning brands, and Pinata will be one component of the new company's operations. We'll still be based out of Seattle, and we'll spend the vast majority of our time planning for and relaunching HeroClix. Point numero two. Hammer of Thor will be the first product release post-relaunch. We're working with several vendors now to see how fast we can get it into market without sacrificing any quality. And the third and final point. We're also working on a press release with the new game company that should help explain how things will work, and we'll give you some of the details of the transition. Because we still don't have a final deal in place, I have to be a little mum on this until we're wrapped. The return of HeroClix.
You know, this could be interesting. It could be a lot of fun. I hope they're able to pull this off and, you know, not foul things up completely, you know, more than they already are, which, you know.
Yeah.
It can only get better from here, I hope, but you never know.
I have the first idea for what not to do. No new rules.
Yeah. Let's change the rules midstream and wipe out an entire collection of figures.
In fact, let's find a way to make all the old figures good again.
Yeah, that would be truly a saving grace on their part if they were able to pull that off. That would be really cool.
Yes, speaking of old is new again.
The announcement that the new core set for Magic the Gathering would cut half of the classic cards that have been in every core set so far elicited many questions. One of the most common, which cards were in every set? A couple of heavy hitters, plus a few vanilla duds you probably won't miss. Only 16 cards have been included in every core set, from Alpha to 10th edition. Magic 2010 will include just 8 of them. The list of 16 is as follows. They're only going to... Gotcha. Mm-hmm. See. Wow. Air Elemental, Bog Wraith, Drudge Skeleton, Fear, Giant Growth, not to be confused with one on my chin, Giant Spider, Goblin King, Grizzly Bears, Howling Mine, Regeneration, Rod of Ruin, there's another joke there, mm-hmm. Semite Healer, Scathe Zombies, and of course, Wrath of God.
Yeah, if you put Giant Growth with your Rod of Ruin, you're going to be in some big trouble.
Yeah, there's penicillin just doesn't cover that one.
Oh my goodness. What he said. Can you believe it, Gamer Nation? They seemed like such nice boys. And then they got a podcast and everything went downhill.
Ask me sometime how I pay for my gaming habit.
Let's not. Let's just not even do that. So, yeah, the interesting thing about the list is that there are just 16 cards, and nobody seems to know at this point which 8 will actually make it into the new set. So, there's your choices, and you have fun debating that, because, it's not going to matter to me. Here's a request that might interest a few techie gamers. Rainer Knizia is looking to see if anyone, publisher or individual, with a track record is interested in programming any of his back catalog that is suitable for the iPhone to sell through the Apple Store. This would be on the basis of a distribution of the proceeds after Apple's cut. If you're interested and think you qualify, then send a note with your credentials and area of interest to the Board Game News editorial address for forwarding to a Knizia representative. Note that Board Game News is acting only as a middleman and has no financial interest in any deals that result. Huh. He's branching out.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he's got what, a couple of games on Xbox Live now?
I believe so. The ones that are downloadable through the Xbox Live service. So, yeah, that's interesting. I don't own an iPhone and don't plan to anytime soon, but, you know, hey.
Right. So, if you have some idea of what you're doing and would like to try at it, send him a line. Let him know.
Because it won't be me, because I have no clue as to what's going on.
Right. And that's not just about games, either. That's yeah.
Yeah, no, that's pretty much the universe in general.
Carry on.
Okay. You can find out more about these stories and other events around the gaming world at three, count them, three of our favorite websites: www.boardgamenews.com, www.gamingreport.com, and, of course, how could we not mention www.robotviking.com.
Say, I'm looking for some sort of abstract strategy game, something with possibly parasitic conflict or bidding and economics, something with majority control and mass marketing, min-maxing that'll make people want to run away in fear and not play anything other than rock, paper, scissors. Have you got anything like that?
What the heck did he just say? It's definition time again, Gamer Nation. Clamp down on the headphones and listen carefully. That sound you hear? That's pure grade A knowledge.
That's not what I was going to call it, but yeah, I'll keep reading. Skill. Noun. A skill, also called talent, is the learned capacity to carry out predetermined results, often with the minimum outlay of time, energy, or both. Skills can often be divided into domain general and domain specific skills. For example, in the domain of work, some general skills would include time management, teamwork, leadership, self-motivation, and others, whereas domain-specific skills would be useful only for a certain job. Skill usually requires a certain environmental stimuli and situation to assess the level of skill being shown and used.
Game. Noun. A competitive activity involving skill, chance, or endurance on the part of two or more persons who play according to a set of rules, usually for their own amusement or for that of spectators.
And now, on with the show.
Well, Gamer Nation, as Andy said in the intro, I have a fairly unique line of work. My job is to help counsel adolescents who have some pretty major behavioral problems. And we're talking anger issues, among other things. And a lot of this comes from the fact that they came from less than pleasant households, I suppose would be the way to do it. Many of them have been abused in one way or another. And anyway, it's kind of my job to help them get back to normal, with a normal set of skills and a normal set of interactions with the general public and each other. And I can go about this in one of two ways. I can either do long, sort of boring lectures, I suppose, would be the word that you would choose to use to describe it. Although, of course, I never find them boring. Or I can try to get things accomplished in a fun and entertaining way. Regardless of the method chosen, the idea is that what we're doing is called skill streaming. We are teaching them skills that they need to get along in life with themselves and other people. And many of these kids come into the program at, 13, 14, 15 years of age, and they really don't know how to interact with people. They have not got any idea how it's supposed to work. And so we try to teach them these skills. And I oftentimes choose to do it with board games. And I suppose some of you have seen a variety of board games that propose to do these same things. There's one, and I use the word loosely, popular one called the Ungame. whose whole idea is to process emotional responses and therapeutic thinking, and it's about as boring as you think it is. Yeah, no, I choose to do it by using games that are more mainstream games that are not specifically targeted to a therapeutic environment. And I find it works better this way because it's something fun for them to engage in, and I can kind of sneak these things in the back door a little bit and get them the skills that they need this way. In general, any board game you come across is going to be able to teach some pretty specific skill sets. Generally, the first skill taught by almost any game is cooperation. You've got to sit down, you've got to cooperate with each other in order to get the game played. And along with cooperation comes the aspect of sharing. You are essentially sharing this game with the people you are playing it with. And, you know, if you can't share, and if you can't cooperate, then you can't play the game. And I use this pretty specifically with any game I bring into the house, because my ground rule is, if you are not going to do these two things, cooperate and share, you are not going to be playing my games. Because what happens is, you will, because of your frustrations, because of your inability to do these things, you are going to have the potential to mess up my game, and I won't let you play it. And since this is a ground rule and it applies to everybody equally, we actually accomplish some actual cooperation and sharing during the course of the gameplay, no matter what we're playing, because it's understood that this applies equally to everybody. The other thing almost any board game can teach you is socializing skills. How to interact with the people you are sitting there playing the game with, how to talk to them, how to get what you need from them, and how to provide to them what they need. So socializing, learning to be sociable around people, is a fairly basic skill concept. A lot of our clients, I guess we'll call them, haven't progressed along what they call the stages of play. Basic play stages are solo play, where the individual plays by himself without interacting with any other people that are in the room with him or anything like that. And this you generally see in children between the ages of, like, you know, 1 to 3, maybe. Eventually what happens is, as they develop better social skills and they start to recognize that there are other people that they can interact with, they step into what's called parallel play. Parallel play means that you're not actually playing with the individual next to you, but you're playing next to them. You're allowing them to, in some cases, play with the same things you're playing with, and you're each doing your own thing, but it's your own thing kind of together. This generally lasts till about the age of 4 or 5, as skills develop further. But the curious thing is, a lot of the kids that we get into our program are just beginning to get to the parallel play stage, and these kids are anywhere, you know, like I said earlier, from, say, 12 on up to 16 or 17. They'll be in the same area, they'll be playing with the same things, but they won't be playing together because they've become so isolated from other individuals that that's just not possible for them yet. What our hope is to get them into the stage they call group play, which you generally see after the age of 5 or 6. And that is, you're both playing the same thing, you're both interacting with each other while you play, and you're essentially sharing your play experience with the people around you. You would be surprised, or perhaps you wouldn't be surprised, depending on your background, how long it can take to get somebody from the parallel play stage into the group play stage when they've reached, you know, over the age of about 10 or so, because these things become very ingrained in them. So we try to get them to go from parallel play to group play, and board games can help us do this. Direction following is also a skill that can be taught with board games. Obviously, board games come with rules, they come with methods of play, and surprisingly, when you're lacking some basic skills, one of the basic skills you usually lack is direction following. You just don't know how to do it, because all of your interactions up to that point have largely been direction-free. Now, there's a difference between directions and orders. Orders you give out and you follow right now. Directions require that you keep them in mind and follow a logical sequence. So learning to follow directions comes in very handy when playing board games and is an essential skill that we try to teach. The other thing that most games can teach is fairness. When you play a game or whatever, it's approximately equal for everybody playing the game, or should be for most games. And of course, we can all think of one or two exceptions to that, but for most games, it's all approximately equal. Everybody starts from the same position, they're all trying to accomplish the same goal, and they're all doing it in essentially the same ways. The problem is extending that fairness out into the real world. Kids come in, and they're very self-centered. Very much all about, what can I get, what's for me, what can I do, and the heck with everybody else. By using board games to teach fairness, they gradually get the idea that, okay, everybody's in essentially the same position, especially in our facility. And only by working as a group and in an approximately equal way can things be accomplished and goals met and achieved. So those are the basic skills you can learn from almost any board game you choose to put on the table. What we want to do with this episode is focus on specific games that teach specific skills, and these skills can range anywhere from basic life skills to interpersonal skills to, everyday skills that most people who have reached, the age of 15, 16, 17 have managed to acquire just by observation and perhaps some instruction along the way that the kids I deal with don't have at all because of their backgrounds and their upbringing and the way they've been treated. They missed getting some of these essential skills. And these are the games that I find particularly useful for teaching a particular skill, and I've used them to teach these skills to some of our clients. The first game I'm going to look at is a game called Bonanza. This is a card game from Uwe Rosenberg, who is not from around here, apparently.
I'd have never guessed that.
Yeah, never. Anyway, he's designed a game called Bonanza, and what this game does is it's about planting beans. You will be dealt a series of cards, and this is the important thing in the game. The order in which you receive the cards is the order in which the cards must remain. You are not allowed to adjust your hand or sort the cards in any way, shape, or form at all at any point during the game. The reason I use Bonanza is because what it teaches is negotiation skills. The only way to alter the order of the cards in your hand is by trading these cards for cards that other players have. As you go through the game, you are required to plant the beans in a series of fields in the order you've received them. The more beans of a certain type that you can plant, the more money they're worth to you when you harvest them. So what happens is, if you have a series of beans and your next card does not help that series, you're going to have to plant it anyway. And if your fields are full, you're going to have to kill a field before you're ready to. So by negotiating with other players, you can trade off or sell these beans that you don't want for beans you do want. This requires you to be able to negotiate with the players at the table. Some of them will want the beans you have, some of them will not want the beans you have. Some will take what you've got even if they don't want it if you talk to them right. Andy, I think, has played this game a couple of times with me, have you not?
Yes. Yeah, this is it's actually a very fun game. But as far as skill sets, it covers quite a few things. The negotiation skill it covers quite well, as you said, because the person sitting across the table from you may not necessarily need or want the cards that you have. But by using your communications skills, you can talk to the other players and negotiate a trade. One of the things that's interesting about it that makes you think ahead a little bit while you're doing this is the cards that you take into your hand, you're going to have to play those cards. So the person across from you who is taking the cards that he may not necessarily want to give you an advantageous trade to get the cards that you want, he's going to have to plant those cards. So everybody's going to have to be thinking about what they need, what they can get, what they can do once they've gotten those cards and put those into play. So You've got to stay on top of what you're doing. It's not just a matter of swapping cards back and forth. You need to be thinking ahead as to how you're going to play those cards as well.
The other nice thing about this game is that out of the box, it will play up to 8 players. This becomes an exercise in learning to negotiate with a whole bunch of different personality types and mindsets. So we like Bonanza. It's a fun game to play just all on its own, but I especially like it for teaching negotiation to people who maybe have never had to negotiate for something they wanted before. Most of them are just used to taking what they want, you know, without any regard for what the other person feels or thinks or needs or does or anything like that. So negotiation skills taught through Bonanza, and I've used it a couple of times pretty successfully. It seems to work really well for this.
Yeah, I think the kids pick up on that pretty quick as far as how they need to negotiate with the other players in order to make an exchange of cards. Because if you say, well, I want that card, you know, here, take this one for it. You know, well, the other player doesn't have to take that card. So you got to be tactful in the way that you approach your negotiation.
Right. Otherwise, you just get stuck and you suffer badly in terms of the game's goal. Our next game teaches... This is more of a life skill, I suppose, than it is a particularly social skill or emotional skill or anything like that. This is budgeting, and the game we like for budgeting money is Power Grid, and we've talked about Power Grid a lot before. Specifically, we've talked about its resource market. I believe we talked about that in the last episode, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
Power Grid, for those of you who have missed all of our previous episodes, is a game about building these power stations across the map, powering them up, and then collecting the money at the end. But the problem is, this money that you've collected in the game is used to finance 3 different and distinct stages in the game. You only get money once per round, and you've got to do all 3 of these stages every round. The first stage in the game is the power plant auction stage. And because it's an auction, you never know exactly how much you're going to have to pay for any given power plant, because everybody else at the table has an opportunity to bid on that power plant as well. So you need to make sure you have sufficient money to get the power plants you want in the first stage. The second stage is the resource purchasing stage, which we spoke about last week. And in this stage, you have what is called the resource market, which responds to the demand for a given resource by increasing its price as more and more of that particular resource is purchased. So if you're playing second or third in line or whatever, the price that you're going to pay for your resources is going to be increased quite a bit just because other people have purchased ahead of you. So you need to have sufficient money for that. The third stage is the actual building of the power plants. And each of these power plants at each location has a specific cost, plus a connection cost to hook up to the rest of your power plants in sequence. So balancing all of these 3 different money requirements can become quite the trick, and generally the person who succeeds at balancing them the best is the one who's going to end up winning the game. So depending on the number of power plants you can power, you will receive more money, and then the cycle starts over again. You need to be aware that what you spend now may not allow you to buy what you need later. And because the market works so well in this game, this is the one I like to use to teach budgeting of money and reserving some money now for what you might want later rather than spending it all at once. It's fairly simple budgeting, but it's budgeting nonetheless. And this is a skill these guys don't have. And many of the ones who come in, sadly enough, aren't going to be going home to, you know, parents who will take care of this for them. They're going to be going into foster care or some other facility or whatever. So they will need this skill eventually, and actually fairly soon for most of them. One of the other skills we find lacking in a lot of these clients is the ability to follow a pattern, or to recognize a pattern even in the first place. Now, I know this doesn't really, for some of you, seem like a very obvious thing, but you use pattern following all the time in your daily life, whether you realize it or not. For example, your morning routine. You know, get out of bed, take a shower, brush your teeth, comb your hair, get ready for work or school or whatever it is you do. That's a pattern. And that's a pattern that repeats every day. And you need to be able to follow it. Other patterns can include, you know, simply the ability to go through your school day, or the ability to recognize a pattern of behavior in somebody in order to tell how they're feeling or what they're thinking. There's tons of examples of patterns that you follow every day in your life, and it's a basic skill. Well, like I said, a lot of these kids don't have it because their lives have been so disrupted by what's happened to them that they don't recognize patterns. They don't see a pattern even when it's, you know, marked out in front of them. So a game I like to use to teach the ability to follow patterns and recognize patterns is a game called Suro. And this is a game from, WizKids. That's who. It's from WizKids, believe it or not. And it's a very nice, very elegant-looking game, very beautiful board, lots of good artwork and that kind of stuff. But the premise of the game is that you lay down these cards that have paths printed on them. And then your stone that represents your playing piece will follow this path, follow the pattern, and try not to run off the board or run into an opponent's stone. So your ability to detect the pattern that's being used and to then follow that pattern can, in a large part, determine your success in this game. It's very simple pattern following. It's an easily marked path. But learning and developing the skill to follow this pattern aids them in other places in their life. Another thing we find with some of the clients we have, in fact with most of the clients we have, is that they tend to have very limited vocabularies. Their language skills are not the best, whether that's because of learning disabilities or because of their social environment that they grew up in or any other reason. Their vocabularies are very small. I don't know if you've ever tried, because I sound like I have a very small vocabulary right at the moment. But I don't know if you've ever tried communicating with somebody whose vocabulary is limited to about 1,000 words. Maybe 1,500 if you're lucky. It's really hard to make ideas and concepts clear to that individual. It's very hard for that individual to communicate what's wrong with them, what they need, what their wants and needs are. And so they have a horrible, horrible time trying to get these needs met. And because of that, they tend to become very reactive. They act out when they cannot express to you what it is they want. It's the only other thing they know how to do, is to act out, maybe in some cases, in many cases, become violent or angry or some other form of essentially what we call a blowout, where they just go completely off the behavioral track. If you cannot communicate what you want, you don't have a whole lot of options. So we like to try to teach them some basic vocabulary skills, words that relate to other words. And we use Apples to Apples, which is a game that gives you a subject and then asks the rest of the players at the table. No, excuse me. It gives you an adjective and then asks the rest of the players at the table to provide a subject that fits with that adjective. And then based on popular opinion or a vote or just personal preference of the person playing the dealer, they select the best word to match with what they gave you. Apples to Apples is very good at expanding vocabularies, because what you learn is that one particular word can fit a whole bunch of different situations. And so as you learn that word and its relation to these other things, your vocabulary naturally grows. Now, I know some people would suggest that games like Scrabble are good for expanding vocabularies, but the problem with Scrabble is that you have to know how to spell in order to play it effectively. Virtually all the kids we get have severe deficits in basic English spelling. There's just no way that Scrabble is going to work with these guys.
Well, another problem you run into with Scrabble is you need an expanded vocabulary to capitalize on that game. Yeah. So that's where I think Apples to Apples really shines in teaching vocabulary.
Yeah, you need to be familiar with a variety of words in order to make any sense out of the tiles you've got. So while Scrabble is theoretically a very fine game, it doesn't fit our needs for this. And many of the other games that require some element of the ability to spell or require a large vocabulary just don't fit our needs. And Apples to Apples is nice in that you've got the words right in front of you, they're spelled correctly, and generally you're given some examples on how the word should be used. So we like that. We find that it helps quite a bit.
One of the things that I've noticed with Apples to Apples is, one, that the kids enjoy playing that game, but the thing that's the added side effect to that game is the kids are learning and having fun while they're doing it, but they don't view it as learning or having to be taught or, you know, something that you have to sit down and do. Since it's played as a game, you're learning while you're playing this game, and you're picking up this extra knowledge and adding to your vocabulary. And a lot of the kids don't pick up on that right away. They view it as just a game.
And that's really the advantage to using board games for all these things, is that as far as the kids are concerned, they're just playing a game. They're having a good time. But you know, as a counselor or a, you know, a therapeutic specialist or whatever you want to call them, that they're also learning these other things at the same time. And it doesn't have to be a big, obvious lesson. It can be very subtle and still work and provide the skills that these children need. Oregon is a game that has you pretending to be settlers headed out to the Oregon territories and establishing towns and shops and various other goods and services. It uses a two-card system. You will play two cards that will have certain symbols on them, and these symbols will tell you where on a grid you can either place people or build structures. The nice thing about this game is that its scoring mechanic allows you to gain points off of structures or people that other players have placed. So what this teaches is what we call mutual benefit. In other words, it doesn't have to be all about you all the time. Sometimes it can be about how you interact with other people that provides the bonus or the points or the good things that you're looking for. By learning to work with other people, by learning to play off of what they do, you can gain some benefit from this. Oregon's a lot of fun. It's got some great artwork, and Andy and I like it because it features our home state. Linear sequence is another skill that these kids are often lacking. This is kind of related to pattern following, but this is more like follow step one, then step two, then step three, then step four. This is linear sequence. And if you go to, for example, let's say you want to get a glass of water, okay? Something very simple. You should know, generally, if you have the appropriate skills, that the linear sequence for a glass of water is get your cup out of the cupboard. Okay, and so open the door, reach in, get your cup, pick it up, close the door. Take the cup to the faucet. Turn the handle on the faucet, place the cup under the stream of water until it is full enough for your liking. Remove the cup from the stream, turn off the water, and then drink. Pretty simple, right? That's a pretty linear sequence. We have kids that cannot follow a linear sequence for a variety of reasons, which I won't speculate on right at the moment, but we have several that cannot follow a linear sequence. So the game I like to use to teach linear sequence is a game called Kalis. Kalis has you building a castle for the king, and in order to do this, you place workers along a track that when you go down this track, each section activates in order, and if you have a worker there, you get the benefit of that location. If you place workers in the wrong place in the sequence, sometimes the things you want to do at the front of the sequence can't be done because you haven't got the things that you set workers on later in the sequence. So, for example, if I want to build a hut, we'll say, I need to make sure I collect wood first before I go to build the hut. It does me no good to try to build the hut before I've collected the wood. I get nothing from it. It scores me no points, nothing at all. And so Kalis, because of the way it works, is excellent for teaching linear sequences, the order of things, order of operations. It can be a very complex game to try to teach, and you need to set aside a good chunk of time in order to do this, because it's also fairly cryptic. There are other games that work in a similar fashion, though. One of which is Pillars of the Earth, which many people refer to as Kalis Light, because it has more of a time limit, is a little bit easier to understand. Another game is called Stone Age, where you're trying to raise your tribe in the Stone Age. And a third game is sort of a linear sequence, and that's the Age of Empires 3 board game, which is based on the computer game of the same name. All of these teach a linear sequence. They teach you how to follow the path, do step one first, do step two second, step three third, all the way down the line. Unfortunately, not everything in life is a linear sequence. Some things are what I'm going to refer to as complex sequences. In other words, many parts need to be completed first before you can go to step two. Fiji is a game by Friedemann Fries. It's a game about collecting shrunken heads. You trade in beads, shiny baubles, whatever you want to call them, for these shrunken heads from some nondescript native tribe. And the reason this is a complex sequence skill set is because the requirements of the tribe and the method by which you turn in things will differ from round to round. There's a series of cards that are placed out on the table that tell you what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to do it in order to get what you want. It changes every round and requires some pretty flexible thinking, in most cases, in order to get what you want out of the end of the line. Andy hates this game, or at least professes to.
This game gives me a headache.
Yes, because apparently his skull splits open and his brains dribble out his forehead about midway through the game. I like it. It's got great artwork, and it, you know, it's silly enough that it will keep kids entertained. I mean, there's even the shrunken heads you're collecting look like recognizable things. There's even a Bert and Ernie shrunken head set.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny when you first crack open the box and see it there. But yeah, Fiji teaches a complex sequence and almost having to have very flexible thinking in order to complete the game successfully. So that's what I use it for. One skill that is almost universally lacking from every client I've seen, and keep in mind, I've been at this job for going on 5 years now. But one skill set I've seen lacking from almost every client we've had is cooperative problem solving. They face it, they have trust issues. They don't trust anybody around them. And they don't trust anybody to do anything right or anything like that. So teaching a client to solve problems in cooperation with other clients or with other individuals is a useful skill for them to learn. It makes life so much easier for them after they've gotten it down. And one of the games I like to use to teach it is a game called Scotland Yard. Scotland Yard pits anywhere from 3 to 5 players against a gentleman called Mr. X. Mr. X has escaped into London from police custody. And it is up to the detectives, played by all the other players of Scotland Yard, to track him down. If you're familiar with the way London works, you'll immediately realize that the problem here is pinpointing somebody down to any one location, because Mr. X never appears on the board except at certain very specific intervals. And he travels by way of either taxicab, the bus system in London, or the underground. And depending on how he travels, he can go to any number of different locations, and it's up to the investigators to figure out where he's going to go next and be there to meet him. If each of the investigators in Scotland Yard plays as an individual, they will never catch Mr. X. Ever. He simply has too many options and too many ways to exercise those options for any one individual to narrow it down and figure out where he is. However, if the investigators work together, they can examine all possible options and make it impossible for Mr. X to go anywhere without being captured. This takes cooperative problem solving. You have to look at where you know Mr. X was recently, use the clues as to what tickets he's cashed in for what he's traveled on and where he could possibly go with that travel, and then maneuver your investigators to be at any of the possible locations once he arrives there. If they work together, they can do that. And they can do it surprisingly fast if they're really on top of things. But what interests us here is the cooperative problem-solving ability. They have got to work together to make the game work for them. If they can't do that, they can't win. A few other games use this same idea. Lord of the Rings, the Rainer Knizia version, has a certain degree of cooperative problem-solving in it, in that everybody has to work together in order to manage their resources in order to be successful in the game. Battlestar Galactica, you're finding your traitor. Your Cylon has cooperative problem-solving elements. There's Fury of Dracula is another game where Dracula's running around the board and then all the other players are trying to track him down in much a similar manner to Scotland Yard. I like Scotland Yard because it's fairly simple. It's easy to grasp for the clients, and it really puts a heavy emphasis on the cooperative problem-solving portion. And I think it's probably the best demonstration of that in the games that I've played or looked at.
Yeah, that also emphasizes the group play ability skills in getting the kids to work together, getting them to communicate with one another, and, you know, going through what cards have been played, what areas he's shown up before, and having them kind of get their brain dressed together and think about where he's going to come up next, and also being able to have the rest of the players go to different spots on the boards and not have them just congregate in one area.
It's an essential skill. I mean, if you're going to get through life and try to do it without being able to work together with somebody to solve a problem, you're going to have a lot of problems all your own. And your life is going to be quite difficult if you can't figure out how to do that. So it's good. It's a good skill to get early on. And most people, this is just a natural thing for them. They learn it through interactions with their family, for, you know, siblings and, you know, friends that they have and whatnot. But the guys I get, not so much, because that family thing doesn't work right. Another skill we look at is being able to determine what I'm going to call relative value. And there's probably some fancy schmancy, psychologically appropriate term for this, but I'm just going to call it relative value. Felix the Cat in the Sack, another game by Friedman Fries, has players bidding on a series of four cats that are in the sack. Each player knows what one of these cats is and what its value is. The idea is to try to bid on a sack that has high-value cats in it. Everybody has a couple of ringers, though, and they get played at, you know, times of each player's own choosing. Each sack is different. And because you know what one cat in that sack is, you have maybe a better idea of the relative value of that sack compared to somebody who doesn't know what your cat is. So if you put a low value or a negative value cat in that sack, to you, that sack is almost worthless. But to somebody else who doesn't know what you've got in there, that sack might seem more attractive. Maybe they put a fairly high value cat in that sack. And this value changes as each player bids out, because a new cat is revealed. So you gradually get more and more information until the actual value of that sack is established. Now you're asking yourself, okay, what's relative value got to do with anything skill-wise? Well, Andy, what kind of cars do you really like?
Oh, well, you know, the ones I can't afford.
Okay, so like a Ferrari?
Yeah, you know, yeah. Ferraris are nice. They're shiny, they're red.
Yeah,
they go fast.
I think they suck. I think they suck. And you're wrong. Ferraris aren't good cars.
Yes, they are.
No, they're not.
They're great. They're Italian. They have to be good.
Well, see, this is relative value. To Andy, Ferrari's a great car. There's lots of things he likes about it. Things maybe he knows about that I don't know about. To me, Ferraris are, you know, rolling trash heaps. They're not worth the money you spend for them. Because my assessment of value depends on other things from what Andy uses to assess value. So the relative value for me for a Ferrari, who cares? For Andy, hey, yeah, that's a great car. Well, we use these kind of value judgments all day long, every day. This is good, that is bad. This is good for me, that is bad for you. That kind of stuff. That's relative value. Based on your information and what you know, you make a value judgment on something. The kids I work with, that value judgment is based entirely on selfish interest. You've got it, I want it. Or, I don't have it, you don't need it.
Okay? Yeah, regardless of what the relative value is.
Right. So teaching a child to understand that just because he likes something doesn't mean everybody else has to, or because he doesn't like something, everybody else has to hate it as well. Teaching them that is not the right way, that's not the way things work, is an important skill. Because this allows them to avoid situations where they get into petty arguments over this kind of stuff. And all these kids have poor emotional control. So a petty argument for them becomes a very major incident in almost no time at all. And it's very difficult for them to manage their emotions. If you can teach them relative value, teach them that somebody who places value on something is no more right or wrong than somebody else who places value on something entirely different, helps avoid situations where their emotional control slips. Along with that goes the idea of abstract thought. The ability to look at a situation or look at a series of situations and think about them in an abstract manner, to kind of disassociate yourself from personal preference in that particular matter and arrive at a decision about it based on empirical fact, basically. So abstracting the emotional value from something and saying, okay, here's what the facts tell me. Here's the mechanically or logically correct choice. And a game called, in this game, you can pronounce one of two different ways. I have not heard anything definitive on pronunciation. The game I like to use for teaching abstract thought is called either Blocus or Blockus, your choice. It's an abstract strategy game which asks you to place Tetris-like pieces on a board in such a way that only their corners touch. And he who can get rid of his pieces first is going to win the game. Problem is, you're playing on a fairly small board, and other players are attempting the same thing. This plays usually with four players. It's like a four-player only game. There's not really a good option for two or three. So you have to abstractly analyze the board, see what's going on, and try to evaluate what is going to be the best move for you compared to what your opponents are doing. And the extent to which you can do this is going to determine how well you can play the game. Other games also teach this. Chess, for example, teaches a lot of abstract thought and looking ahead and that kind of stuff. Checkers, kind of an abstract. There's Go. There's a whole bunch of other also, you know, more current games, more modern games that do this same thing. But I like Blockus for it because it's a very colorful game. The kids relate to the pieces right away because most of them have spent all too much time playing video games anyway, so they know what Tetris is. And they kind of have an idea of how the game is supposed to work from the get-go. You know, you just adjust a few conceptions about where to place and how to place and go from there. So I find Blockus is easier to teach and easier to get kids into than, say, chess would be or Go or some of the other ones. So for abstract thought, I generally go with Blockus.
Blockus.
Yeah, whichever. Blockhead. Next on our list is a game called Wits and Wagers. Now, Wits and Wagers is a party game, essentially. It's meant for kind of a fun atmosphere with, you know, a lot of your friends around and that kind of stuff. But it does teach something very nice. It is essentially a trivia game. But it's the kind of trivia game where you don't have to be right to win the game. You just have to be close enough. And what I use Wits and Wagers to teach is that it's okay to be wrong. Because it's entirely possible for someone to be wrong about every answer they give and still win the game. Because the game rewards the individuals who are closest to the answer and closest in selecting the correct answer. Essentially what happens is you are given a question. This question has usually a numerical answer. Everybody writes down their guess as to what the answer is going to be. These answers are sorted from high to low. And the answer that is closest to the correct answer gets points. And people who selected that answer get points. Now, the thing of it is, as I said, it teaches that it is okay to be wrong. Because we get kids in who are in the mindset that they can never be wrong. And I don't just mean they have the opinion that they're never wrong. They have almost a genuine fear of being wrong. So what you get from them are either no answers, no communication, no kind of valuable therapeutic talk, because they're afraid that they're going to say something wrong, or they're going to do something wrong, or they're just going to be wrong, have the wrong information, and be embarrassed or ashamed or made fun of or mocked or, and I realize made fun of and mocked are the same word essentially. But anyway, they have this fear of being wrong, and Wits and Wagers goes a long way towards teaching them, hey, it's okay to be wrong once in a while. You know, you learn more if you're wrong, in fact, than if you try to be right all the time.
Yeah, it's kind of like horseshoes and hand grenades. You only got to be close.
Right. Horseshoes and hand grenades. Thank you so much for that. Must remember to take hand grenades to work.
It always makes for a fun party.
Yes, it does. So Wits and Wagers is useful for teaching this concept that you know, it's okay to be wrong. You can learn more. And close sometimes is good enough. It really is. You don't have to be perfect. And in fact, most of the time, you can't be perfect.
Yeah, the whole walking on water thing, I always get wet.
Yeah. Well, you're walking on the wrong side.
Oh, that's what it is.
Okay, we have another Freedom and Freeze game called Fearsome Floors. In this game, you play a group of children who have somehow wandered into the worst monster-haunted castle ever. And you go in one door, and you have to try to get outside through this large room. You have to try to leave the room in order to win the game. The problem is, there's a monster in here, and he is hunting you. And if he finds you, he will catch you and eat you. Okay, so scary stuff, right? Well, not really, because it's done in a pretty fun way. But what we use Fearsome Floors for is to predict likely outcomes of choices. You can move your characters up to whatever number of moves is printed on the face of the character. And then once all the characters have moved, it's the monster's turn to move. And let me tell you, he moves quite a lot. In most cases, if he moves into a position where he can see you, he will move towards you and attempt to eat you. There are several cards that allow him to move until he catches somebody and eats them. At which point, the first time you're eaten, you have to start over. And the second time you're eaten, well, you're really dead this time. So what it helps with is the skill of looking at your choices, deciding where you're going to move or what you're going to do, and then trying to work out and predict where the monster is going to move to and whether or not he's going to attack you or somebody else. Some of the kids we get live in this kind of vacuum where they believe that their choices and their actions have no consequences and that it is impossible to predict what the consequences of any given action or choice is going to be. If you stop and think for a moment, I think you'll realize what kind of problem this is going to turn into if it's allowed to continue. And while most of our kids are all pretty good kids that are just a little messed up, there are the occasional one or two who take this philosophy of my choices and actions have no consequences to its most extreme limit. It's not a good thing, and they need some way to be introduced to the idea that what they do matters. And I can do that through lecture, but it's going to take a lot of lecture over a long period of time. If I use this game Fearsome Floors, I can help speed that process up a little bit. It's not the perfect tool. And it's not, you know, it's not an instant fix. And none of these, in fact, are instant fixes. But it is a tool that helps make that process go a bit faster and helps them realize that, yeah, it is possible to predict what the outcomes of your actions are going to be and to begin taking responsibility for their actions, which a lot of them really need to be able to do. The final game we're going to mention, and this is kind of a funny little mention here, but it does actually teach a lesson. The Gamer's Bermuda Triangle. Bermuda Triangle has you sailing a ship around, the Bermuda Triangle, going from port to port, collecting goods until you reach a specific dollar amount, and then you win the game. There is a cloud in the middle of the game, which by random dice roll will move in a specific direction and turn in a specific way. And underneath this cloud are little magnets. And in the top of the ships that you're moving around the board are little magnets. And what happens is if this cloud passes over your ships and the magnets contact each other, your ship disappears. and does not return. And this happens fairly often, because it is a pretty darn random move on this cloud. It goes all over the place in fairly unpredictable ways. What we use Bermuda Triangle to teach is that bad things happen, and it's not always your fault. Sometimes they just happen, and it's up to you to deal with what comes after. This, in most cases, is probably the most important thing we can teach these kids, because these kids have all had bad things happen to them. And every one of them comes into our situation thinking it's entirely their fault that these bad things happened. Now, some of them, yes, have created their own situations, their own bad situations. But a lot of it is the result of things that, as I said at the beginning, have been done to them. And that they're not responsible, they're not the responsible party for what happened to them, what was done to them, whatever abuse or whatever it is that they suffered. It's not their fault that somebody did that to them. But at the same time, they are responsible for the things they have done. Just like whoever did whatever it was they did to them are responsible for what happened. So, sometimes it's important to understand that you know, bad thing A was, you know, somebody else's fault entirely. Because they carry that guilt around with them. In a lot of cases, they come from homes that have been broken up, or they've been removed from the home that they're used to. And, you know, somebody's upset about the whole thing, and they're blaming the kid in the first place. And they need to understand, to even get this whole process started of getting better and getting back to what could be considered normal, they need to understand that bad things happen, and it's not always your fault.
You've waited all this time to tell me that.
Yeah, well, you're kind of a roving bad thing there, Andy. I don't know.
Yeah, not unlike the Cloud and Bermuda Triangle.
Yes, the Cloud and Bermuda Triangle.
Just random.
So, Gamer Nation, that's kind of what I do. And these are some of the things I use to do the job I do. These are all in and of themselves great games, even if you're not looking for games that help teach skills and lessons. We've enjoyed playing each of these games, and we find them to be a lot of fun. But understand that sometimes a game is more than just a game. Sometimes it's, you know, a little bit of therapy. For whatever reason, you know, even if you just need, like, some time off from a little bit of reality, you can break out a board game and play it. And, you know, maybe learn something about yourself along the way. So, yeah, this is sounding like an ABC After School special. Give it some thought. If you work in a therapeutic situation, or you work with people who need some skills training, or, you know, they just need a better grasp on what's going on around them, maybe you can find a game, either from our list or one you particularly enjoy, that can teach them some of the skills they need, or help teach them the skills they need. And keep in mind, I'm not really licensed for anything, and I'm not qualified officially to offer particular advice or particular therapeutic approaches or anything like that. These are just things I use to do the job I do. I don't specifically recommend one or the other as being absolutely the only way to do it, or to be a substitute for, you know, appropriate therapy or anything like that. It's just a tool, all right? It's like working on a car. I don't recommend one brand of screwdrivers over another brand, but you might need a screwdriver at some point when you're working on a car. So that's what our approach is here.
Pipe wrenches and sledgehammers.
Yeah.
On the table.
Well, sometimes Gamer Nation, Brian and I get to play games. Or nearly play games, at any rate. This week, Jake came over, and we got to try a game we've had on our radar for a while now.
Yes, and that game would be Primordial Soup, or as it's alternately titled, Soup.
Soup. Yeah, was what I was saying through most of the game, scratching my head, trying to find out where my amoeba were going to go.
Yes. You will be playing the part of an individual who has been given some sort of control over a series of amoebas. And these amoebas will either drift around the board based on current weather conditions or environmental conditions, or alternately they will move in a semi-directed way if you choose to pay your price and roll the dice thing. While they're moving around, the object is that they try to eat these food cubes that are laying around in this water, this primordial soup. And if they eat the right number and right color of food cubes, well, they poop. And they poop in their own color. And then other amoebas come along from other players and eat that poop. And then they poop. And there's pooping everywhere.
This turned out to be a crappy game.
It's, you know, we're about halfway through it because Jake had to take off early. I like the game. I like what I've done so far. I should point out that as you go through the game, you can acquire mutations that allow your amoebas to do different things. Move faster or move further or eat more efficiently or poop more efficiently or or fight or any number of other things. So there's a lot of upgrading of your amoebas, which is a sentence I never thought I'd utter. But apparently I just have. And, you know, it is a fun game. I do enjoy it. I just don't know where it's going and how complicated it's going to get by the time we get to the end of this thing.
I'm thinking it's going to get a whole lot more complicated as we progress, because it's already looking like next round or two, there's going to be a bunch of dead amoeba.
Yeah, your amoeba take damage if they can't eat enough. Yeah, so there's some starvation. I'm trying to think of the board in my head right now, and I know it's sitting in front of you, but how many spaces are on that board?
Oh, what do we got here? 15, 16 odd spaces, and it's not set up in a complete square. I mean, there's a couple empty spaces on one end of it, so it's kind of lopsided on one side.
Yeah, and we each have 7 amoeba, correct?
A total, yes. A
total of 7 amoeba. And that's 3 of us playing. That's 21 amoeba. There's a decreasing number of food cubes on each. We're going to get a lot more death. There's going to be a lot more dying before the end of this game.
Yeah, there's a total of 19 available squares.
Okay, so yeah, it's going to be crowded, and there's going to be dead amoeba everywhere by the time we hit the end of this game.
Yeah, and the thing about it is the more amoeba that you have on the playing board and the more mutations you have, the more points you score every round. However, if everybody is doing this and everybody has all of their amoeba out, your food sources quickly diminish, and then comes the starvation and the dying of amoeba. So while you're trying to get as many amoeba out there as you can and get them move around and score your points, you're also depleting your food supply, your amoeba are going to die, and then you're going to score less in each round. And I think that's going to be a cycle that we run through here real quick.
Yeah, I think we're heading up to it real shortly. Because I got what, 5 amoeba out, 4 of them have damage counters?
I believe
counters.
So. I've got 5 or 6 on the board. 5 on the board, yeah.
5 on the board, and how many of them have damage counters?
4 of them.
4 of them? Yeah, and Jake's probably no better off than we are.
No, he's, I think he's got, yeah, he's way worse off. He's got 6 on the board, but only 3 of his have damage counters. Mm. But I'm seeing bad things for all of us here in the next round.
Yeah, so this next Thursday we're going to try to finish this bad boy up. And we'll let you know how that goes. It's looking, from what we were just talking about, like it's going to go badly for somebody pretty soon.
Yeah, but I don't think it'll be, you know, completely and totally fatal once that occurs. No. I think it's going to be a you know, as it were, an evolutionary scale in this, where they'll build up, they'll move about, they'll die off, and then they'll build up again. So I think it's going to be a reoccurring.
It seems to be the natural cycle of the game for that to occur.
Right.
This is the first time we're really going to hit it.
Yeah. Yeah. We're probably 4 or 5 rounds into this so far.
Yeah. So Primordial Soup, it's kind of hard to find, is my understanding, because it's not out of print, but it's heading that direction. So if you can find this somewhere and it sounds interesting to you, it might be worth grabbing. And it's about, $35, something like that.
Yeah, and if you're like us and you're into the wooden meeples, the wooden bits and stuff like that, this game's got a lot of them.
Oh yes, tons.
It's got different shapes for your amoebas, and each one of those has a little wooden dowel that sticks out of it. It's got little beads that you use for damage markers. It's got cubes for the food. It's got coins for your generic or genetic points and stuff like that. It's got a lot of stuff to it. It's really quite colorful. So
yeah, like I said about 4 times so far, I like this game.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. It's different.
Yes. So what have you been looking at this week?
Well, I think I had seen this game before, and for whatever reason, it just never set in with me. But I was doing some of my surfing on the internets the other night and came across a game called Pulp City. And this covers a couple of things that you and I both like. For me, it's a miniatures game, mm-hmm. and which is something I enjoy. And something that you enjoy, it's a miniatures game dealing with superheroes.
Woo-hoo!
And supervillains.
Awesome.
And the neat thing about it is the rules are free to download off of their website, which I believe is pulpcity.com. And it's looking pretty interesting. I'm liking the way that the rules are starting to shape up. I've been trying to read through a little bit, and it's got some really interesting characters to it. So it's looking like it might be some fun. So one of these days I'll get my printer fired up and get those printed out, and we'll get a game on.
Yeah, I just happen to have some superhero miniatures we can use too.
Yeah, I noticed that. I think I've got a few laying around my backyard somewhere.
Yeah. And be forewarned, Gamer Nation, you'll spend about 20 minutes watching the animation on the website. Just kind of cycle through. I still haven't quite figured out what's going on with that, but it's got some pretty funny bits in it.
It's hilarious because it covers, I mean, just about anything and everything you could think on there. I mean, there's a little girl that wanders out onto a terrace and picks this guy up with what looks like a little death ray and pretty much throws him off the end of the building. There's UFOs abducting people. Mm-hmm. Godzilla wanders to the background and eats a building.
Yep.
Tentacles burst out of some guy's face, and you know,
yeah, it's this crazy animation. I don't know what the deal is with it, but it's great. I love it.
There's all kinds of little music and animations and stuff going on in the background. So yeah, if nothing else, check out the website just to watch the animation of it. But if you like miniatures games and if you're in any kind of superhero type of thing, it might be something that clicks for you.
Yeah, that's Pulp City at, I believe, www.pulpcity.com. Well, Gamer Nation, it's time for the end of the show, and that means it's time for Back Chat. First comes the sweeping up. Gamer Nation, I screwed up last week.
You?
Me. I realize that seems impossible.
It does. You're omnipotent.
And omniscient, and several other alms. When I was talking about Merchants of Amsterdam and its wonderful Dutch auction mechanism complete with wind-up auction clock, I got things completely backwards. What I should have said when describing the clock was that it counts down from the high price to the low price, not low to high. That makes no sense. That's just silliness. Who'd wait to pay more? I was probably thinking about my bills. Stupid me.
Yeah, because if you wait to pay them, they usually give you a late fee. That's man, we need to have Dutch auctions for our bills. That'd be great.
Yeah,
that would be awesome.
I'd go for it.
Heck yeah. Well, let's see, what do we got here next? Dragon Man wrote in with the following novel. Email. You will eventually know me as Dragon Man from the forums, assuming, of course, I stop catching up on every D20 radio podcast from the beginning and start communitifying. to find, which is a word I know because I just made it up. Oh, I was going to have to say he had to have made that word up.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I'm glad he didn't say communification. Yeah. There goes our rating.
Anyway, I've recently chosen to catch up on your show, and aside from your baseless insulting of RISC 2210, which is the only tolerable version I have found, has both amused and educated me.
Now, I'm going to take objection to that statement.
We didn't.
Our insulting of RISC 2210 was not baseless.
No, absolutely not. No. It was well-founded.
That's right. Carry on.
I think we put that out there. So I decided to issue you a challenge. We take your challenge. Which, of course, needs a tad more prefacing. So here goes. Some time ago, a puny little company of... Oh, man, I just...
No, that's not your fault. That's the way he wrote it.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I thought it was my fault. And some time ago, a puny little company known as the Warlocks of the Beach... get that reference, or some such, published a really cool game called Three Dragon Ante.
It's so subtle, I don't know if I can...
It really is, like, Warlocks of the Beach. I love that. It's subtle as a brick through a plate grass window.
Plate grass?
Plate grass. It's yeah.
That, okay, whatever.
You weren't supposed to catch that. my vast vocabulary.
Can I recommend a game for you, sir?
TDA was a decent game, but all in all, a tad nerf-coated for my taste. I wonder if he's a nerf herder.
Move on.
Got off on a tangent here. I responded by bending my great will and my multiply... God bless it. People, use your spell check.
The problem is it's spelled right.
It's just not the right word. Okay. I responded by bending my great will and my multiply published game design talents. It should be multiple published game talents. Sorry, I'm. Is 0 times 0 multiply? Well, yes, it is. To writing my own Poker of the Realms.
And I am not touching that with a 10-foot pole.
No, I'm not, because... There was a vision there, and there was a sentence forming, and I'm just gonna flush that one. Mm-hmm. Poker of the Realms. That's another. Okay, the result was a 2-page Word document that, for convenience, I converted to Google Docs format. Docs. Okay.
Yeah,
I'm having a hell of a time here. Mm-hmm. In all its batter fried awesomeness. Love batter-fried awesomeness. Google Doc stripped out all of my fancy formatting, making the rules much harder to read, but at least they are all there, including a quick way to make a playable deck using 2 standard decks of playing cards. My challenge to you, assuming you choose to even get this far in this email, and we have, and it's been difficult, but thank you, is to use the guide to make a deck. Sit down with each other and anyone else you can drag to the table and try it out. I see Jake playing this game. Mm-hmm. My local gaming group quite enjoyed the game, but I was looking to double the playtesting pool's depth since my wife was kind of obligated to say it was cool. Yeah, I don't think she was obligated. I think she was just sugarcoating your sensibilities. And others may have been...
I hate it when my sensibilities get sugarcoated. high blood pressure. I don't know.
Yeah. Stress not popping out of my forehead. Wow, he'll never send us another letter. And others may have been parroting just to get to the barbecue beef and dice rolling. Barbecue beef. Again, with the magic food. How do these gamers pull this off?
I don't know. I'm not. But I want to know where he got barbecued dice.
I don't know, but that sounds good.
Yeah, because it says barbecue beef and dice rolling.
Yes.
I don't know. And why would you roll barbecued beef?
I'm not sure, unless you had sprinkles down somewhere. Otherwise, you're just going to get, you know, bunnies and stuff on it. Wow. Feel free to contact me via email if you have any questions about how to play, comments on how to improve the game, or any other general banter. Oh, banter we have. I have a big basket I like to put banter in. As a final footnote,
Sir?
What?
Would this be considered banter poodoo?
I wasn't going to say that, but I'm glad you... He truly is a scruffy nerf herder.
Yeah.
As a final footnote, if you have any tips on getting published thing, that would be 7 2/3 kind of cool.
Okay, first off, sir, Mr. Dragon Man, sir. 7 2/3, yes. Mr. Dragon Man, challenge accepted.
Sucker.
You have opened the gates. Beware what you unleash.
I've thrown down the gauntlet and I foolishly bent over to pick it up.
That's right. Secondly, and we to further elaborate on our gates statement, we haven't played it yet. We are aware of its presence. You have made that available to us, and we will be checking it out sometime in the near future. Secondly, about your 7 2/3 kind of cool game publishing tip idea thing. My first tip is playtest. Playtest, playtest. Oh, you're doing that. But I mean really open it up for everybody to playtest. You asked us not to reveal the web address of the location of your documents and all that, and we have respected that request. But if you want this thing to work, then you need to build in your local area a playtest community who will be trying this thing out. And what you're going to do is you are going to hand them the rules, hand them a deck of cards, leave them with a small survey so that they can express whatever opinion it is they have of the game, plus whatever areas you wish to have more information about, and then you are going to walk away and let them play. The reason you're going to walk away is because you will find that they will be more honest about things if you're not standing right there hovering over them, trying to answer questions and keep them interested in what's going on. So that's how you get some honest playtest feedback. And you're not going to do this just once with the same group of people over and over and over again. You are going to do this many, many times with as many different gamers as you can find to do it with.
Yeah, definitely. The more groups, the better.
And then you are going to listen very carefully to their feedback. And some of them will lie to you. There's no two ways about it. But it will be up to you to figure out whether that is a useful lie or not. And to take whatever information you get from everyone else and decipher it and figure out what you can do to make the game better. Only after you have had multiple playtests should you even think about submitting it to anyone. Anyone at all. When you do submit it, make sure you have multiple copies available to yourself. Because you are going to include more than one copy in the playtest or in the published submission to whatever company you send it off to. And then be prepared to wait a long, long time. Because any company, any publishing company that accepts submissions from outside will have a ton of them to get through. And then they will have to play test it over and over and over with multiple groups. So you can figure from point of submission to hearing back one way or the other from anybody is going to be, at a minimum, I would say, 5 to 6 months.
Yeah, if not longer, depending on who you submit it to.
Right. So be patient. Be prepared to wait like you have never waited for anything before. If you've done your homework, if you've done good playtesting, if you've got a game that's worth playing, then hopefully you will hear back favorably. If you don't, do not be disappointed. Just pack it up and submit it to somebody else, and repeat until it works.
One of the things I've noticed over the years, especially with video games, but also with several board games here lately, is... people get an idea in their head and they think it's cool beyond words, and they just put it into production, or they submit it, and whoever else thinks it's neat puts it into production, and there just wasn't enough playtesting. They don't take the time to work the bugs out of it and get the game to a playable state. And that's the important thing is playtesting. That's where you work your bugs out. That's where you iron out all the kinks. That's where you make your rules addendums. I think that's a problem that Warlocks of the Beach ran into with their Clix games. You know, changing the rules midstream and causing as many problems as they had for themselves.
Not Warlocks of the Beach. That's the other one. Whiz Kids.
Oh, well, you know, there was a W in there somewhere.
Yeah, something, whatever. Similar words. Very good. Yeah, okay. So that's our advice on getting published. And it's really, really comes from not so much our own experience, because I don't think Andy and I have tried to get anything published game-wise or any otherwise.
No, not recently.
What this comes from is the many threads posted on Board Game Geek that deal with getting games published and playtesting and things like that. And I would highly recommend that you try BoardGameGeek.com and read up on what it's like and what you can do and get all kinds of other good advice and things from them and those that have tried. Now remember, Gamer Nation, you can contact us at www.d20radio.com through the community forums or email us directly at gameon@d20radio.com. Ask questions, comment on the show, send us your bumpers right there in the email. Ask us to play test things. Give us a shot. We're friendly guys, more or less.
Yeah. Bumpers, just like on the front and back of your car. We need bumpers.
Yeah, bumpers. But anyway, yeah, if you've got a game you want us to check out or whatever, send it along. We're not adverse to trying new things. Unless it's that hot sauce they got down at the Taco Bell. That's, yeah, no. So until next time, Gamer Nation,
game on.
This podcast is intended for entertainment and educational purposes only. All specific names, titles, or products mentioned are copyrighted by the respective rights holders. Some sounds and music are provided courtesy of Soundsnap.com and Freesound.org. Reboot is copyright Alliance Entertainment. All original content of this podcast and its related website are intellectual property of Game On and D20 Radio.
Second stage, and the first stage is an auction. So you're gonna the amount of I'm gonna start that all over.
Okay.